I think that the main problem between these negotiations between Putin and Lukashenko is that Belarusian people, they do not know what is the sense and details of these meetings. Yeah, we can't influence on Alexander Lukashenko on decisions, and there is no possibility to express your opinion now in Belarus and to influence on the situation, and even any attempt to exercise your rights in Belarus now is strongly repressed by authorities. It started in summer 2020, and till today the situation goes only worse and worse.
Can you tell us about your colleagues in prison right now with Vyazna?
Sure. Today is exactly 8 months, and they were, as three of my colleagues were arrested, and they still now at pretrial detention center, and we don't know any details of their criminal case because nobody tells us the details. And we see that there is an investigation, but it's not very active. And actually, they are like blamed in doing a financial crime, but these repressions about human rights defenders from Vesna, it's only because of their human rights job. And I also would like to remind that my colleague, coordinator of volunteers, Marfa Rabkova, she was arrested in September of 2020. So about a year and a half, she's in prison waiting for a court trial. And she faced up to 20 years. She could receive up to 12 years of prison. And there are more than 1,000 of political prisoners in Belarus. And the conditions where they stay, they're awful. It influences extremely on their health, and there is at least one case when a person died in Belarusian prison, a political prisoner. So I really call you to keep in focus this topic also, political prisoners in Belarus, and to spread this information, to show your solidarity, and to support them by sending letters and postcards of solidarity from all countries from the world.
Natalia, can you talk about the latest referendum held just last week, and the referendum opening the door for Russia to station nuclear weapons in Belarus, and the significance of this?
Yeah. The results of this referendum, it was like, as we expected, unfortunately. The whole process was done in this atmosphere of fear and repression. And those people who tried to protest against the results of the referendum, they were arrested on Sunday, on the elections day. And also, there were no free media, no access to any information except propaganda, state propaganda. And, of course, we can't rely on the results. And like this referendum, as all previous elections in Belarus, they were no free, no fair, and it's not the result of people's voting.
And the repression in Belarus after and during the protests that began in 2020, and Russia's role in the suppression of those protests?
Of course, we see that the Lukashenko regime is so strong because of the support of Russia and Putin personally. We do not see Russian forced agencies in Belarus. I mean, during the protests in August 2020 and later, but we know that it could happen. And that's a very strange situation when one state influences so much on other independent state.
We're going to do part two of this conversation. It's so rare to speak to someone from Belarus. You have left the country. We're speaking to you now in Vilnius, Lithuania. Natalia Satsankevich is with the Belarusian human rights group, Vyasna. Part two will be at democracynow.org. We dedicate today's show to our colleague, Brent Renaud, and to all those who've died during this invasion. He went to Ukraine to document the refugees from Ukraine and global refugees around the world. That does it for our show, Democracy Now! Accepting job applications for Human Resources Manager. Check out democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Felsmeitberg, Messiah Rhodes, Amin Sheikh, Maria Tersena, Tamri Warnoff, Camille Baker, Sam Alkoff, Tamria Studio. Special thanks to John Alpert and Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman.
RCT in sound from way out.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Peter Kuznick, professor of history at American University and director of the university's Nuclear Studies Program.
Nuclear war is a central question facing all of us right now. Stay tuned.
We also speak today with Professor Karina Mullen, a political economist.
What are the nuts and bolts behind all of what's going on now in Ukraine? She knows. Listen in.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
The Nuremberg Tribunal called aggression, quote, the supreme international crime, end quote, because it contains within it all other crimes. German Nazi leaders were tried, convicted, and hung at Nuremberg for the German war of aggression. They began in September of 1939 when they invaded Poland and started World War II. The guilty verdicts at Nuremberg were not merely victor's justice. Its precepts were incorporated into the UN Charter. The Charter, which is a treaty ratified by the countries of the world, established a process for keeping the peace and, quote, to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, close quote. War is outlawed, with the only exception being self-defense after an armed attack or with the permission of the Security Council of the United Nations. Russia is guilty of aggression against the Ukraine. But that being said, the United States has baited the Russian bear repeatedly, starting in 1990 with the breakup of the Soviet Union. At that time, U.S. Secretary of State James Baker promised the Russian leader Mikhail Gorbachev that the U.S.-led NATO organization would not move, quote, one inch, close quote, east towards Russia. This promise was broken. The Russians were betrayed. Since then, NATO has recruited 11 former Soviet bloc and Warsaw Pact countries into its military organization. Led by the United States, NATO is an organization that has played an aggressive role, having carried out the bombings of Serbia, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, and Libya. NATO has placed missiles in Poland within 100 miles of the Russian border. Missiles on the long border between the Ukraine and Russia could hit Moscow in 10 minutes, making it impossible for the Russians to defend themselves. Russia's attempt to make the United States understand they have crossed a red line has been consistently rejected. This is not to defend Russia's actions, but to place them in historical context. The world now has come to the edge of an abyss. A nuclear war could easily be started, annihilating all of humanity. The rule of law must be restored. Russia must honor a ceasefire and withdraw. The United States must forswear arming Ukraine and recruiting Ukraine into NATO. Ukraine must go forward as a neutral country like Austria or Finland. Today, we speak with Peter Kuznick. He is a professor of history at American University and directs the Nuclear Studies Program there. Peter and Oliver Stone wrote the book, The Untold History of the United States, and also produced a Showtime documentary series based on the book. Peter Kuznick, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Glad to be with you today.
Peter, the world's facing the most dangerous crisis since the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. What are the parallels between that crisis and the current situation in the Ukraine? What's the current risk of nuclear war?
Yeah, the parallels is that the world is on the brink of nuclear war again. And as you say, it's the closest we've been to war, world war, and nuclear war in 60 years. You know, there are some parallels, but one of the ones that strikes me as least similar is that in 1962, the U.S. had between a 10-to-1 and a 20-to-1 advantage over the Soviet Union in the number of nuclear weapons, the number of bombers that could hit the other country, and the number of ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles. In the aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis, especially after Kennedy and Khrushchev were off the scene by 1964, the decision in Moscow was to never be in a position of weakness again where it would have to back down because it was so outgunned. And Russia, Soviet Union, moved quickly for nuclear parity. And that's the case now. You know, so we have a situation where Russia is actually the biggest nuclear power in the world. Russia, again, after the U.S., you know, some context on some of this. In 2001, after the U.S. was hit on 9/11, the first international leader to reach out to the United States and offer support was Vladimir Putin. But the U.S. response was to kick Putin and Russia in the teeth. In 2002, the United States abrogated the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the ABM Treaty. In 2003, the U.S. invaded Iraq over the objections not only of Germany and France, but very strongly over Russia. In 2004, Russia expanded NATO dramatically for a second time, including the Baltic states on Russia's borders. Then in 2007, Putin makes his famous speech at the Munich Security Conference, in which he deplores American unipolarity, deplores American hypermilitarism, and says that he's no longer going to tolerate any further NATO expansion, that this is his red line. How did the U.S. respond to that? In 2008, George W. Bush announces that he wants to put Ukraine and Georgia on a fast track for joining NATO. That was in many ways the provocation that really began a lot of what's happening now. William Burns, our current CIA director, was then U.S. ambassador to Russia. Burns wrote back a memo to the White House titled, "Niet means Niet. Don't cross Russia's red lines." This is what American statesmen and policymakers have been saying for years. Don't cross Russia's red lines when it comes to NATO expansion, especially Ukraine and Georgia. But the U.S. did, and Russia responded by invading Georgia in 2008. And then after the Maidan uprising in 2014 and Russia seizing Crimea and supporting the rebellions in Luhansk and Donetsk, this continued. And in 2018, in Putin's State of the Nation address, he announced that Russia now has five new nuclear weapons, all of which can circumvent U.S. missile defense. He said, you didn't listen to us. Listen to us now. And yet we still didn't listen. And we can go into a lot of the history, but in 2019, when Zelensky got elected president with 70% of the vote in Ukraine, he did so on a platform of wanting to reach out to Russia, resolve the tensions, go back to the Minsk II agreement from 2015, and resolve the crisis between them that way. And when he started to reach out to Russia, he got hit so hard by the nationalists inside Ukraine that he had to back down. And then it was at that point that he started to welcome in more and more NATO armaments, more and more NATO trainers, speak negatively about Russia, and then demand Ukrainian admission to NATO in a much more voluble way. So in 2018, Russia announces its 5 new nuclear weapons. Once this crisis began, and especially the latest phase, Putin started to make threats about using nuclear weapons and threatening the West if they got militarily involved, they were going to see destruction of a kind that they had never experienced before. Then he put his nuclear forces on high alert. Then he began the attack the attack at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant, the largest nuclear plant in all of Europe, and starting a fire to the adjacent building that created the danger of a breach of the containment potentially and the spreading of massive amounts of nuclear radioactive waste throughout Europe and Russia. That would have been extraordinarily dangerous. And even yesterday, the Ukrainian foreign minister was warning that the Chernobyl plant had power had been cut off to Chernobyl, that they lost communication with the workers there, and that he feared an imminent catastrophe. There are about 20,000 spent fuel rods stored at that plant, have to be maintained with water to cool them on a regular basis. And so if the electricity was cut off, the fear was that the water would not circulate, and spent fuel ponds and keep the rods cool, and the reaction could occur. The head of the IAEA gave assurances that this would take weeks before the catastrophe was realized, but it was another wake-up call. And then you put that all together with the fact that Putin has his control over 6,000 nuclear weapons. And that he's been sounding increasingly irrational, unhinged, out of touch with reality. His statements leading up to the invasion, saying that, first of all, that there was a genocide going on in the Donbass. There was no genocide going on in the Donbass. We know what genocide is. There was aggression going on there. There was shelling, but it was far from genocide. Saying that Ukraine was run by neo-Nazis and drug dealers? Lunacy. Saying that Ukraine was always part of Russia? I mean, the history there is much more complicated. So people did not know if Putin had simply lost his grasp on reality. We know that he's surrounded by yes-men, that he doesn't tolerate any dissent. He doesn't have anybody around him to challenge him. Now, we saw those visuals of him sitting 20, 30 feet away from the closest people he was talking to in all those meetings. You know, nobody knows how much of a grasp of reality the guy still has. And the fact that somebody in that position, at a time when militarily things are obviously not going well for him in Ukraine, at a time when he's politically isolated, when there's a crisis in his own country, the fact that he's got access to 6,000 nuclear weapons is and should be terrifying. And so that's in terms of the nuclear dangers. And if this spills over, if it spills over to Poland or Romania, countries that are supplying arms to Ukrainians at this point, we don't know what Russia is willing to do to interdict that, to stop those flow of arms. And so if Russia does bomb on purpose or inadvertently Poland or Romania, does that trigger Article 5? Does NATO get involved militarily? And the fact that Zelensky had, until now, been calling for no-fly zone and getting support from some hawks in the United States, as well as some military, former military officials in the United States, I mean, that is lunacy. You know, the Americans have shown, and what we're willing to do, that many American leaders are willing to fight to the last Ukrainian. And now with Zelensky's call for a no-fly zone, the Ukrainians have shown that they're willing to fight to the last American and to the last person on Earth. Because, you know, fortunately, Biden did not go for that. And Zelensky, as a result, has been sounding like he's much more willing to compromise right now, which is positive. And I hope that something proceeds along those lines, because this is just, aside from the humanitarian catastrophe being suffered by the people of Ukraine, which is heartbreaking to watch, aside from that, the implications in terms of involving the world in a much bigger and far more dangerous crisis are just terrifying. And that's why this has got to be stopped, and stopped immediately.
Peter, of course, a no-fly zone would mean that we would start shooting down Russian planes, and that would be, I think, the catastrophe you're talking about. But how do you think the situation in Ukraine could be de-escalated and defused? Do you think we should call for an immediate ceasefire, the withdrawal of Russian troops, no NATO in Ukraine, and the neutralization of Ukraine, say, along the lines of Austria or Finland?
I'm with you on all of those. I think that's part of the answer, or that's most of the answer. And that's what Putin has been saying that he wanted from the beginning. He wanted neutralization of Ukraine. He wanted a guarantee Ukraine would not join NATO. He didn't want any further NATO expansion to the east. He wanted recognition of the independence of Luhansk and Donetsk, the breakaway republics, and he wanted agreement on Crimea. The interesting thing is that Zelensky, in his March 7th ABC interview, said that, I quote him, he says, "I've cooled down regarding the question a long time ago after we understood that NATO is not prepared to accept Ukraine." So he basically said he's willing to accept that Ukraine joining NATO is off the table. He also said in that interview that he's willing to accept neutral status, that he's willing to negotiate the independence of the Donbass republics, and that he didn't say that he's willing to go along with Crimea, but they can agree to disagree about that. So he's effectively given in on almost all of Putin's most fundamental demands. So I think that we're a lot closer now than we were even 2 or 3 days ago to the possibility of a resolution along those lines. You know, many of us were saying that before this even began. I must have done 75 interviews on Russian TV in the 3 months leading up to this war. And my message to Putin was declare victory, you know, and remove those troops, defuse the tension, start the diplomacy. The world has finally, after 30 years, been talking about and understanding the seriousness of Russia's national security concerns. NATO expansion to include Ukraine and Georgia was off the table. That was not going to happen probably in Putin's lifetime. NATO and the U.S. were talking about compromising and negotiating about missile deployments in Europe, about military exercises, about transparency. Putin was in a position to declare victory and to send those troops back to their barracks. This was, if there was ever an unnecessary war, this was it. But Zelensky would not say this before when he had a chance, even though I urged him to do so. Biden and NATO would not say this before when they had a chance, even though it was obvious that this was the way to prevent the war, which is obvious, which is so horrific and catastrophic. And so, I mean, this whole thing could have been avoided. Now, it's, you know, had the United States done what Zelensky had been demanding and given more armaments and given the fighter jets and more Stingers and drones, then maybe Putin would have acted sooner. You know, it might not have been to Ukraine's advantage to get that or to demand that. The other problem was the United States and NATO, while not giving any security guarantees to Ukraine, and whereby saying that we would not get involved, were still egging Zelensky on to resist. There was a strong faction in the United States who saw this as the West's opportunity to take down Russia further, to weaken Russia, to discredit Russia, to turn Russia into more of a pariah state, to cripple Russia's economy. And I don't think they anticipated that the Russian military would be so inept, so incompetent. But I thought that they could really weaken Russia in other ways. And so there were many people who welcomed this, in the same sense that in 1979, Brzezinski's whole goal toward Russia and Afghanistan was to induce Russia into invading. I mean, Brzezinski started to arm and fund and support the Mujahideen. He said to Carter, this is going to force Russia to intervene, and we're going to be able to give the Soviet Union its own Vietnam. And so even though publicly they decried this and said this is a horrible thing, Russian aggression, privately they broke out the champagne and they were celebrating. I don't think a lot of these people give a crap about what's happening to the Ukrainians. And I think that they would rather, in a geopolitical sense, use this to further weaken Russia. But those of us who really care about the Ukrainian people, who really care about war and peace, who really want to see a peaceful and prosperous world, have got to do everything we can to end this fighting as quickly as possible before the chance of this spilling over into a much bigger conflict continue.
Peter, what is the extent of U.S. military power in terms of its nuclear arsenal, number of foreign bases, and the strength of its Army, Navy, and Air Force? How does Russia and the rest of the world measure up to this immensity?
Nobody's got military power at all comparable to the United States. I mean, we saw, even in Afghanistan and Iraq, the U.S. can blow things up. The U.S. military can destroy a country in very, very quick order. Occupying a country and rebuilding a country is something else that we're not capable of doing. But the United States budget, military budget, is about 10 times the size of Russia's military budget. And now you've got these calls. Some of these loonies are calling for doubling U.S. military spending. They can't find money for schools. They can't find money for child care. They can't find money for building homes. They can't find money for so many human needs, but they can always find money that'll end up in the coffers of the defense contractors, or as they're more appropriately called, and were called after World War I, the merchants of death. And so that's one of the consequences of this. But the U.S. military, I think that one of the lessons that we're learning from this is that so much of that money that went into modernizing the Russian military was probably siphoned off into these yachts and these coffers of these corrupt billionaires, because the Russian military is not very efficient. The command and control of this operation seems to be pathetic. This convoy, 40-mile convoy, that's been on the road to Kyiv for more than a week and has been stalled because of the logistics, because of supply lines, looks very, very, very weak and disorganized. The Russians are taking some heavy casualties already. Now, we know that the Russians have not deployed much of their forces. They've got a lot of materiel and hardware and other things that they can do, and far more soldiers they can throw into this. But this has given the Russian military a real black eye. The United States, under Obama, you know, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for his Prague speech, supposedly calling for nuclear abolition, actually saying that the United States will not be the first country to give up its nuclear weapons. The United States will be the last country to do so. Obama should give back that Nobel Peace Prize and apologize. But one of the worst things he did was to inaugurate this 30-year trillion-dollar nuclear modernization program designed to make America's nuclear weapons more efficient and more lethal. Now we know it's going to cost at least $1.7 trillion, but it's underway. But the U.S., we don't know what the effectiveness of Russia's nuclear arsenal is. There's every reason to suspect that they could wipe out the United States and anybody else they wanted to. I wouldn't gamble on the fact that the incompetence that we're seeing on the ground in Ukraine now would also carry over to the nuclear realm. You have to realize all it takes to cause a nuclear winter. When Sagan and the scientists in the 1980s were warning about the effects of nuclear war in terms of triggering nuclear winter on the, across the planet, they actually overestimated the threshold for nuclear winter. The latest scientific studies show that a limited nuclear war between India and Pakistan, which 100 Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons were used, would burn the cities, send up so much smoke, soot, and debris into the atmosphere that it would circle the stratosphere within 2 weeks, block the sun's rays from hitting the Earth. The temperatures on the surface of the Earth would plummet. Much of the agriculture would be destroyed, and up to 2 billion people could be killed. That's 100 Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons. The world has approximately 13,000 nuclear weapons, and they're not Hiroshima-sized. Most are between 7 and 70 times the size of the Hiroshima bombs. So just do some of the math, and you can figure out how vulnerable we are as a planetary species. And right now, there are two people who've got veto power over the future existence of life on our planet. Joseph Biden, who's exercising a measure of restraint, at least, and Vladimir Putin, who's behaving as if he's unhinged. So we're in a precarious situation. But the U.S. strength is enormous. The U.S. still has an empire of approximately 800 bases around the world. My friend and colleague David Vine has been writing about that brilliantly for quite some time. But the U.S. has got enormous capabilities. We don't need to keep on feeding this vast death machine that we've created. We've already got everything we would ever need to defend ourselves and defend our allies, but not against a nuclear power. Because, you know, one of the sad things that's come out of this, I did an interview yesterday with Japanese media, because former Prime Minister Abe and many others, including leaders of the LDP, the ruling party there, and some of the leading alternative parties, are calling for nuclear sharing with the United States inside Japan. Japan, the most anti-nuclear country in the world. Japan, the victim of America's two atomic bombs in 1945. Japan, with the Article 9 of its peace constitution, with its three anti-nuclear principles, is now a strong faction there is saying that the mistake that Ukraine made was giving up its nuclear weapons, and that Japan doesn't want to be in that position vis-a-vis Russia or China or North Korea. This is the kind of insanity that's being provoked by this invasion. And I think that if it's happening that way in Japan, it's going to happen that way elsewhere, too. And you know, and the tragic thing is that there is some truth to that insanity. That the point that North Korea made when the U.S. invaded Iraq, the North Korean official newspaper said the mistake that Saddam Hussein made was not having nuclear weapons. If he'd had nuclear weapons, the U.S. could never have invaded. And I think he was probably right in terms of North Korea, might have been right in terms of Ukraine. That's not the world we want to live in, because we know that the more countries have nuclear weapons, the greater the risk of those nuclear weapons being used. Biden, give him credit. When this began, he said the U.S. is not going to send troops. The U.S. is not going to fight Russia. And that he canceled the ICBM test last week because he doesn't want to give any additional provocation. That's the exact right thing to have done. You know, but now we've got to get on the same page and begin to, and end this before any of this happens.
Peter, unfortunately, we've run to the end of our allotted time, I wanted to ask you the big, big question on how we prevent the spread of nuclear arms, and we haven't got there. So I'd like, on behalf of Marjorie and myself, to invite you to come back to talk about that key, key question. And in the meantime, can you tell our listeners how they can follow your work?
Well, I'm doing interviews constantly, which, you know, anybody who asks me, I'm more than happy to do it. One of the things I've been stressing is the need for China to take the lead on these negotiations. Hopefully we'll have a chance to talk about that some more also, because I see that as the only viable off-ramp. Xi Jinping is the only one with actual leverage over Putin. And I mean, I could go in depth, but it'll take a little while. People can email me at Kuznick, K-U-Z-N-I-C-K, at American.edu. And I just write and try to do interviews and webinars every chance I get, because the world needs more historical perspective. And we can't solve these problems unless we understand what caused them, how we got to this point, and what's been the effect of 30-plus years of American attempt to gain unipolarity and how that's created an unbalanced world.
Peter, thank you so much for your interview and giving listeners a perspective that they don't get, certainly not in the corporate media, but we really look forward to having you back soon.
I'd love to do that. Thanks.
Peter, thank you so much. You take it easy.
You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace.
Horrific images of the war in Ukraine, and now more than 2 million displaced persons streaming over Ukraine's border, continue to emerge. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is calling for a no-fly zone over Ukraine, and the corporate media is hyping more punishing sanctions against Russia. So far, Joe Biden has resisted calls for a no-fly zone, apparently mindful that enforcing a no-fly zone would mean the U.S. Air Force shooting down Russian planes and bombing Russian ground installations that provide Russian forces with anti-aircraft support. That could well devolve into a nuclear confrontation. The United States and other Western countries have imposed sanctions against Russia, including expelling some Russian banks from the SWIFT financial messaging system, essentially barring them from international transactions and effectively blocking Russian exports and imports, as well as banning imports of Russian oil and gas. But these sanctions harm not the Russian oligarchs, but the Russian people, while raising gas prices for people in the United States. The prospect of cyber warfare lurks in the background, which could redound to the detriment of people around the world, including those of us in the United States. Meanwhile, the U.S. and its allies continue to send massive armaments to Ukraine to the delight of the huge military contractors. While Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine constitutes illegal aggression, prohibited by the UN Charter. It is necessary to analyze the history and geopolitics, as well as the role NATO has played in the region, in order to understand both the context for the conflict and how it could have been prevented. Today, we are fortunate to have with us on Law and Disorder Radio, Corina Mullen, an organizer and professor of political science and political economy at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and Brooklyn College, CUNY, in New York. Corina is a member of the steering committee of the International People's Tribunal on U.S. Imperialism, Sanctions, Blockades, and Economic Coercive Measures. Corina, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here.
Corina, please give us some background for the war in Ukraine. What role has NATO played? Why is Russia so insistent that Ukraine doesn't join NATO? Why did Vladimir Putin say on February 21st, if Ukraine was to join NATO, it would serve as a direct threat to the security of Russia? Has NATO outlived its original purpose?
Thanks for that, Marjorie. I just want to begin by saying how worried I am as someone committed to global justice and peace, as both you and Michael are as well, and the program itself. So how worried I am by the current conjuncture, and in particular by the possibility of nuclear war that the crisis in Ukraine seems to be moving us closer to. So the NATO militarization of Europe and the Russian intervention, I think, really highlight that the world has reached this dangerous fork in the road. Our concerns, of course, must be with the poor and working class, who are always the primary victims of the dislocation, destruction, and death of war, with those in Ukraine facing direct bombing, as well as the indiscriminate bombing of people in the Donbas region, who have really endured years of state repression and neo-Nazi attacks, and the working class Russian people now facing crushing sanctions. And I also just want to point out and highlight the mass refugee exodus that's been prompted by this crisis, and in particular the experience of African, Asian, and other racialized migrants living in Ukraine who have been subjected to the racist treatment at the hands of Ukrainian and Polish officials and undermined by the racist logics and physical, psychological, and environmental violence of militarized imperialist borders, which remind us really of the need to respect international law and basic humanity in honoring the rights of all people, regardless of race and nationality, to freedom of movement and to seek asylum. So I also want to mention, and this is connected to the question of NATO, how discussions of Russian aggression in the mainstream media and by U.S. politicians have tended to obscure the U.S.'s own history of violence, including, of course, over 400 years of slavery and settler colonial genocide, dispossession of indigenous lands, as well as interventions across the globe. We know that the U.S. has been responsible for overthrowing countless foreign governments, dropping countless numbers of bombs on countless numbers of countries, assassinating countless numbers of leaders, suppressing popular movements, interfering in democratic elections, and of course the U.S. maintains close to 800 military bases in more than 70 countries. And so another aspect regarding these distortions in the media depictions, I'd like to highlight specifically how it weaponizes amnesia around, for example, NATO's enlargement, and tries to confuse us about the directionality of cause and effect in order, as you know, Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman famously put it, to manufacture consent around never-ending war, which, of course, is a staple of this country's political economy. It should be stated from the outset that not only is NATO a central tool of U.S. imperialism in Eastern Europe, but across the globe more generally. NATO is a Cold War institution that was designed to counter the Soviet Union and undermine the prospects for communism and self-determination globally. Some of its earliest interventions were to prop up colonial regimes like Portugal and France in the face of anti-colonial revolutions on the African continent. Although NATO is a Cold War institution, there was actually an uptick in its military operations after the Cold War, and including, of course, interventions in Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Somalia, Yemen, and the leading role it played in the 2011 military intervention and regime change in Libya. NATO, which we know is led by the U.S., has been steadily expanding eastward in Europe for decades, contrary to assurances made to Russia and contrary to the demands of workers across Europe. In the absence of any threat to itself, NATO has expanded from 16 to 28 members in the post-Cold War period, bordering Russia on the Baltic coast and threatening to encircle it entirely. NATO has, since the fall of the Soviet Union, become Europe's main foreign policy-making body, and even to the point of dominating domestic economic interests. NATO requires member states to maintain high levels of military spending. The current agreed target for European NATO members is 2% of GDP spent on defense by 2024. In 2020, 10 NATO countries, including the U.S., reached or exceeded the 2% target, more than in 2019, including for the first time France and Norway. And in doing this, NATO secures the central place of the military-industrial complex in the global capitalist economy and ensures the profitability of never-ending war. So when thinking of NATO, we also need to think, consider more than just its members, more than just its direct interventions, more than just its expansion eastward in Europe, and increasingly encroaching on Russian borders. There are also the non-NATO military alliances with the U.S. that many people don't know about. 20 countries are currently designated major non-NATO allies from across the globe, and that includes Brazil, Bahrain, Egypt, the Philippines, Thailand, and Tunisia. These relationships also result in the increased militarization of states and borders, increased spending on militaries versus productive and development sectors on the economy or in public goods like healthcare, housing, and education. And also, although through requiring Global South states who are members to engage in U.S.-led military and security trainings, intelligence sharing, and other forms of imperialist unequal partnership, they break down possibilities for Global South solidarity and alternative ways of imagining security and really the potential for decolonizing international relations.
For those who've tuned in late, we're speaking with Corina Mullen, who's a professor here at CUNY in New York City. Corina, what role did the United States play in the 2014 coup in the Ukraine? How did that coup lead to the present situation?
Right. So to understand the current crisis, we need to go back a little bit further to at least 1991 and understand the active military force and aggression the U.S. has used against Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union. Although, of course, we can't understand even the fall of the Soviet Union without understanding U.S. constant aggression and attempts to undermine the Russian Revolution. So NATO's expansion has been a well-known security concern for Russia since 1999, when Bill Clinton inaugurated the official process of growing NATO's membership to include former nations of the Warsaw Pact, despite promises made that this would not happen. So instead, the U.S. Policy executed by Bill Clinton and subsequent administrations was to wage a new military expansion via NATO, further militarizing the region and expanding U.S.'s sphere of domination. So since 1999, NATO has absorbed 14 Eastern European countries, including Estonia and Latvia, which share borders with Russia. But the more immediate causes of this crisis include the consistent prodding of Russia since 2008, when NATO put the inclusion of Ukraine and Georgia, both bordering Russia, on the table. And then they also include, and this brings me to the coup, the U.S. and EU and NATO-backed coup in 2014 against Viktor Yanukovych, against a democratically elected government that was opposed to the country's subservient relationship with the EU and positioned Ukraine, which shares a 1,200-mile border with Russia, as a neutral country. The coup replaced the elected government with a government that made NATO membership a policy mandate. So since 2019, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has repeatedly requested Ukraine's entrance into NATO. NATO's eastward expansion has enabled a hostile military alliance to blanket the region with missiles pointed to reach targets in Russia within, some people say, less than 10 minutes. The U.S. has never abandoned its provocative posture while the Russian government's appeals to address its security concerns have fallen on deaf ears. So during his time in office, also Donald Trump withdrew the U.S. from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces and Open Skies Treaty. Those are two agreements that were aimed at limiting U.S. and Russian nuclear weapon deployments and securing a lasting peace among signatory parties. Under Biden, the U.S. has continued to push for the expansion of NATO. With the help of Israel, the U.S. Has armed, trained, and funded the Ukrainian military, including its neo-Nazi and far-right elements, as it has prosecuted an eight-year war on the regions of Donetsk and Luhansk, including laws compelling the use of Ukrainian as part of a systematic attack on ethnic Russians. It has also actively sought to undermine Russian economic development and relations with EU nations, such as the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project with Germany. And the goal of punishing, rather, Russia, rather than averting a conflict, was apparent on February 26, when Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky opted out of negotiations over neutral status with Russia and kept Ukraine fighting, most certainly under U.S. pressure.
Karina, please explain the role of imperialist economic policies and interventions, for example, by the EU and U.S.-dominated International Monetary Fund in Ukraine following the fall of the Soviet Union, but particularly after the 2014 coup, and the social, political, economic impact this had.
Right. Thanks for that question. So in addition to the role of NATO, we can't understand the 2014 coup and current crisis without looking at the U.S. strategy to open Ukrainian markets to foreign investors and to give control of its economy to giant multinational corporations. This is an element, I think, that's often lacking from even left analysis of what's happening in Ukraine. As the political economist Prabhat Patnaik has argued, where the general role of the IMF is to open up economies around the world for the penetration of metropolitan capital by making them investor-friendly through the adoption of a host of anti-working class and anti-people, so-called austerity measures involving the taking over of natural resources and land areas by metropolitan capital. Ukraine is one of the examples where the IMF has directly supported the U.S. government's Cold War objectives. The IMF, which leverages aid loans to push governments to adopt policies friendly to foreign investors, the IMF is funded by and represents Western, especially U.S., financial capital and governments, and has been at the forefront of efforts to reshape economies around the world for decades, leading to increased debt and dependency in the global south and reinforcing global hierarchies in the international system. So in the Ukraine, the IMF had long planned to implement a series of economic reforms to make the country more attractive to investors. These included cutting wage controls, so for example, lowering wages, privatizing and reducing government spending on health and education sectors, which made up the bulk of employment in Ukraine, and cutting natural gas subsidies to Ukrainian citizens that made energy affordable to the general public. Those involved in the 2014 coup, like U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland, repeatedly stressed the need for the Ukrainian government to act these so-called necessary reforms. In 2013, after early steps to integrate with the West, Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych turned against these changes, as I mentioned earlier, and ended trade integration talks with the EU. Months before his overthrow, he restarted economic negotiations with Russia in a major snub to the Western economic sphere. So the U.S. was upset with Yanukovych's audacity to turn to Russia instead of the IMF, and they decided to restrict further damage to their interests, and that is a large part of why he was overthrown in this U.S.-sponsored coup. And these elements, and especially thinking about the neo-Nazi elements who were involved in that coup, have now become, of course, formally incorporated into the Ukrainian army through the inclusion of it in the Azov Battalion. The resistance, also it should be said, to the Maidan coup has continued from 2014 to today. And after the coup, the new government quickly restarted the EU deal. After cutting heating subsidies in half, it secured $27 billion commitment from the IMF. The IMF's general goals include reducing the role of the state in economies in order to open them up, as I said, to Western finance, and therefore generate greater dependency on the imperialist core, as well as to de-develop economies and to cheapen labor. The political economist I mentioned earlier, Prabhat Patnaik, in a recent article, points out this huge IMF loan to the Ukraine was notable for several reasons. First, it was much larger, in fact, more than six times than the IMF would normally provide in a comparable situation. Second, it was given to a country in the midst of civil war, which is against usual IMF practice. And third, this is what makes it comparable to the kinds of loans that the IMF gives to Global South states on a regular basis. It was known from the very beginning that the loan could not possibly be paid back, so that the only means through which it could be sought to be recovered would be through metropolitan capital taking control of the country's land and mineral resources, the most prominent of which is natural gas. The so-called structural adjustment policies that the IMF imposes entail the dismantling of all trade and capital controls, privatization of public assets. So after the 2014 coup, for example, the US-EU IMF-backed government attempted to privatize almost all of its 30 ore deposits, which is pretty unprecedented. And also introduced so-called labor market flexibility, which means basically attacking trade unions, which is probably one of the reasons, I think, that the trade union building in Odessa was targeted by neo-Nazi firebombing. I think more than 40 people were killed during the 2014 coup as a kind of disciplinary measure. It also explains the crackdown on the left, as the government that took power in Ukraine in the wake of the U.S.-backed so-called Euromaidan coup of 2014 outlawed the Communist Party and banned it from running candidates in elections. The party's youth group was also made illegal, and its members were subjected to political persecution by the police and in the courts.
Marina, how should the conflict in Ukraine be resolved? What does Russia want? What is Ukraine likely to agree to in negotiations, and what role, if any, should the Minsk agreements play in a settlement?
Yes. I think we need to consider what are the main interests motivating the U.S. in this escalation, and that, I think, relates to what kind of settlement we can imagine coming out of this. So, of course, the main interest, I think, motivating the U.S. in this escalation of aggression is the fear of losing its economic and political hold on their NATO allies and other countries in the region under its sphere of influence. As many have seen, their major opportunities for gain to lie in increasing trade and investment with China and Russia. Ultimately, I think it's also about blocking the possibility of Eastern and maybe even Western Europe from breaking away from NATO and U.S. dominance, and of the emergence of a new multipolar world order centered on economic integration and in economically integrated Eurasia, including China and Russia. Some analysts have argued that the long-term dream of the U.S., new Cold Warriors, is to break up Russia, or in Michael Hudson, the left political economist words, to restore its Yeltsin-Harvard boys managerial kleptocracy. But regardless, we know that there must be a political settlement. In my opinion, it seems Russia's core demands are not outrageous, that Ukraine stay neutral and out of a hostile military alliance and Russia's borders, as well as to recognize the breakaway republics, as well as denazification of the military. The fact that the U.S. officials deem these positions as maximalist and claiming that there's no rush to negotiate seems to be a signal that U.S. officials are happy for this crisis to go on as it suits their interests. You know, we know the military-industrial complex is benefiting and the other geopolitical interests as well from the ongoing conflict, the ongoing crisis, even if and as people are dying. So we on the left, I think, should be calling for, at this point in time, peace, definitely. But as the Black Alliance for Peace said in their recent statement, and I quote, peace is not merely the absence of conflict. Peace means the achievement through popular struggle and self-defense of a world liberated from militarism and nuclear proliferation, imperialism and unjust war, patriarchy and white supremacy. Peace also means dismantling a military-industrial complex that is clearly profiting from endless war and intervention. So we need to reinvest that bloated military budget into public goods and fighting racialized inequalities in sectors like health and childcare, public housing and transportation, education, as well as the struggle to combat climate devastation. And ultimately, I also agree with the Black Alliance for Peace statement that we need to dismantle NATO for the same reasons we need to abolish the police. Both serve the interests of capital and empire at the expense of the global working classes. And that's a quote from their statement as well.
Karina Mullen, unfortunately, we're running to the end of our allotted time here, but I know that you're involved in the People's Tribunal on U.S. imperialism, and I wanted to ask you about that. Can you talk to us about the initiative that you've taken in that respect?
Yes, and I think also we can connect it back to the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia as part of the broader war on Russia. The latest round of sanctions imposed on February 24th, which includes imposed asset freezes on Russian government officials and banks, equity restrictions on Russian mining, transportation, and logistics firms. And already it's having, as well as removing some Russian banks from the worldwide interbank financial telecommunication, SWIFT financial messaging system. Already it's having a devastating impact on the Russian economy and the Russian people. There's been severe currency depreciation, wiping out close to $200 billion in stock market value and roughly a third of the country's sovereign debt. So, you know, we know that this benefits all of the war on Russia and the broader Cold War, which includes the war, Cold War on China, benefits the military-industrial complex. It benefits the financial sector, the oil sector. And so what the People's Tribunal on U.S. imperialism is trying to do is really to hone in on the role and the central role of sanctions as a tool of imperialism that really is used to undermine and discipline global South sovereignty and to ensure that the unequal hierarchy within the international system and the persistence of a U.S.-dominated neocolonial capitalist global economy is maintained. And so this tribunal, the tribunal is co-sponsored by organizations that are located throughout the world, including the Committee of Anti-Imperialists in Solidarity with Iran, National Lawyers Guild, the Simón Bolívar Institute for Peace and Solidarity Among Peoples, the International Association for Democratic Lawyers, Al Auda, Palestinian Right to Return, Samidoun, Palestinian Political Prisoners, Black Alliance for Peace, Answer Coalition, Code Pink, People's Forum, many more. And I just want to say that in collaboration with international scholars and activists and legal experts, the People's Tribunal will host an introductory webinar to discuss the urgent need to take legal actions against U.S. sanctions and economic coercive measures on March 18th at 9:30 a.m. PST time. We have a great lineup of speakers, and you can find more information if you email us at info@sanctionstribunal.org, and you can register at https://solidarityiran.org/.
Give that email again, will you please, Karina?
Sure. So the email is info@sanctionstribunal.org.
Excellent. Well, I think that we're going to have to say goodbye, unfortunately. We've run out of time.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today and giving us the perspective of a progressive political economist that very few of us see, certainly not in the corporate media. So thank you so much for joining us, Karina.
Thank you so much for having me, Marjorie and Michael. I really appreciate it and enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, every success in your work.
Thank you so much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
DJ Haim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
I'm here to tell you, in case you don't know it, that you got a new generation of black people in this country who don't care anything whatsoever about us. They don't want to hear you, old Uncle Tom, handkerchief heads, talking about the eyes. No. And the first thing the cracker does when he comes in power, he takes all the Negro leaders and invites them for a coffee. To show that he's all right. And those Uncle Toms can't pass up the coffee. So this is a con game. And this is what they've been doing with you and me all these years. This is why I say it's the ballot or the bullet. It's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
That's Malcolm X, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Malcolm X, The Ballot or the Bullet. Welcome to this special Black History Month program. Malcolm X is a singular figure in African American history. He led a most remarkable life. He was born in an impoverished family in Omaha, Nebraska, on May 19, 1925. He recalled being dizzy with hunger. He said, "My whole life has been a chronology of changes." Indeed, it was. He went through a series of remarkable transformations, from being a street hustler known as Detroit Red, to going to jail, to converting to Islam, then breaking with Nation of Islam leader Elijah Muhammad, and becoming an independent voice for Black dignity, self-reliance, and economic independence. He challenged the racist white power structure and the blacks who went along with it. He was only 39 years old when he was assassinated on February 21, 1965, in New York. The poet Maya Angelou said of Malcolm, "His aura was too bright." He had a charismatic presence and a radiant smile, and he was an electrifying orator. At his funeral, Ossie Davis called him a prince, our own black shining prince. The speech you are about to hear, The Ballot or the Bullet, was one of his most important and famous ones. It ranks number 7 in one listing of the 20th century's top speeches. He spoke in King Solomon Baptist Church in Detroit on April 12, 1964. And now, Malcolm X.
Mr. Moderator, Reverend Klieg, brothers and sisters, and friends, and I see some enemies. In fact, I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we had an audience this large and didn't realize